Let's go ahead and get started in this session. We know it's getting late in the afternoon and people are running a little behind, but we probably need to get going. This is session number 174, and it's entitled BYU, Spiritual Violence, and LGBT Activism. We have a panel discussion with three participants here who have recently been involved in some significant activism, and I think they're going to tell you about some of their experiences and some of their impressions. Let me just introduce the three panelists briefly, and then we'll let them run with their own show. At the far end of the table is Mike Kramer. Mike is a high school teacher who works with youth and on social justice issues. His life goals, including falling deeply in love, raising children with the love of his life, traveling the world, and every day making life a little bit better for everyone. Mike likes chocolate ice cream, but doesn't like chocolate. He was raised in Alaska, but dislikes the cold. He studied business in college, but instead of working in the industry, making lots of money, he decided his calling was to teach school. That is, not making lots of money. He works extensively with youth and on social justice issues. His goals in life are simple: to fall deeply in love, raise children with the love of his life, travel the world, spoil his grandchildren, and every year, every month, every week, and every day make the world a little bit better place for everyone. That's Mike. In at this end of the table is Matt Kulish. Matt is a former BYU student who was arrested for trespassing during the 2006 Soul Force visit to campus and disciplined by the school. He's now attending the University of Utah. He came out to his family at the age of 19. He grew up in Spokane, Washington, where he ran cross country for Lewis and Clark High School and attended youth activities in the Spokane stake. Matt had his first boyfriend at age 18 and came out to his family as gay at 19. He served a full-time mission for the LDS Church in London. He attended BYU from January of 2004 until April of 2006. While a student at BYU, Matt met Emil Polig and Mike Kramer, the other two panelists, and as friends they stood with the 2006 Soul Force Equality Ride during their visit to BYU Provo, which was in April of 2006. After being arrested for trespassing during the Soul Force action, Matt was disciplined by university officials. He chose to leave BYU and now attends the University of Utah, where he is pursuing a degree in English literature as a full-time student. In March and April of this year, Matt joined the 2007 Soul Force Equality Ride as a two-month volunteer, including planning this year's visit to BYU Provo. He now serves as the youth representative on the Soul Force Board of Directors. And then in the middle, our third panelist is Emil Polig, also a former BYU student who was disciplined by the school for his involvement with the 2006 Soul Force visit. He's now working as a waiter in Salt Lake City with plans to go back to college in the fall. He came out to his family in his early 20s. He was born in Richmond, Virginia. He's 25 now and the third of five children. He graduated from Pulaski County High School and attended Brigham Young University for a year before serving a full-time mission in Milwaukee. He returned to BYU in 2003 to continue his education. As a student, he met Matt and Mike through LDS Family Fellowship, which is an organization that some of you will be aware of. Shortly thereafter, he came out to parents and sisters as gay. In February of 2006, Emil learned of the intended visit to BYU by the 2006 Soul Force Equality Ride later that year. He contacted the organizers to get involved. BYU disciplined him for his involvement, but not before he was accepted to the University of Utah to continue his education. We're so grateful for the University of Utah for rescuing people. I'm a University of Utah graduate, so I can say that. In March and April of this year, Emil joined Mike and Matt on the 2007 Soul Force Equality Ride. He officially organized the visit to Yellowstone Baptist College in Billings, Montana, and worked in an unofficial capacity to help organize both the BYU Idaho and the BYU Provo visits. He now works as a waiter, as I mentioned, and plans on attending school this fall. So, with that, those are our three panelists. We'll let them take it away.
Can you guys hear me into that? Is that all right? No.
We need to use the mic because of the tape.
Oh, they're recording it.
Yeah.
You don't want to record this. We had planned to introduce ourselves. There's not really much I wanted to add except a little timeline difference. I had actually met Matt before I came out of the closet, and he was sort of instrumental in helping me do that. This is my third year at BYU, and I would earlier that fall I'd been made Elders Quorum President, and in that capacity realized several things about myself and decided I needed to make that change. And so my experiences there were pretty intense. The next semester, maybe Matt coming out to my parents, coming out to my state president and bishop all at once, and it was crazy. I guess I'm here really to introduce what we're planning on talking about. The title of this is called BYU Spiritual Violence and LGBT Activism. Basically, what we're going to sort of an outline of what we're going to be talking about is what it's like for us. Both all of us went to BYU for a little bit, and we're going to give a few stories about that. We're going to talk about what the difference is between prejudice and discrimination, and basically what that entails. We're going to talk about spiritual violence, also the activism that we've done, and kind of what maybe what you would like to see us do. We also have a small video about our stop to BYU that we did on the ride, and then after we'll have some questions. Hopefully, though, we don't want this to seem too much like of a lecture. So, if you guys have questions in between, we can answer them. Then we will. So. It's already starting to feel like a lecture to me, so I'm going to stop. And yes, ma'am.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
What is the ride? Is it a bus, a bicycle, or you're all in cars?
Actually, it's funny that you say bicycle.
Geography, are you covering like several states?
Sure. All right. Okay. First, I better explain what the ride was to begin with. A guy by the name of Jake Rayton had this idea. After meeting a gay student at Wheaton College. He was like, well, it sounds to me like these colleges have these policies that discriminate against lesbian, gays, bisexual, and transgender individuals, and they really don't know anything about it. The students don't know anything. The administration, or all their information is based on false ideas. And so... He decided, much like the during the civil rights where they had the freedom rides, that he was going to create this ride that went across the country and visited these universities that had these discriminatory policies. And we would go onto their campuses and we would talk to the students and interact in dialogue about these issues. And so last year, 2006, was the first equality ride. And there was, how many, 34, roughly. They know better than me. 34 students, or young adults at least, that traveled the country, and they came to BYU, Provo. And BYU's reaction was sort of like, we'll ignore them up until the last day. And then at the last, the day before they were supposed to go on campus, they were like, okay, well, since you're planning on doing this, and we can't seem to stop you. You're not allowed to go here, here, and here, and here, and this is, pretty much all you can do. And so they went on. They really didn't have any expected idea of what the reaction would be like at BYU, but I would say it was pretty obvious that the students wanted that dialogue, that they wanted to talk about it. Tons of people showed up on the campus, and although I like to joke that there were more people in black suits than there were students, there's so many security there. Anyway, the ride. Okay, so yeah, last year it was just one bus, and they went from like the east to the west. But this time, this year, 2007, they split it up into two halves and two buses. So Matt, Mike, and I went on the West Coast bus, traveling. We started in Minneapolis, kind of went south and over to California, and then back up to Minneapolis. The other bus did the eastern route. So yeah, that's what it did. So I guess we'll turn over time to Matt or Mike.
All righty. The first part of the topic that we wanted to talk about was what it would be like for a student who is gay at BYU. Now, we do realize that our three experiences are not the only experiences that have ever been had at Brigham Young for gay students. I attended BYU from 2000 until 2004. I graduated from there. And about the same time as I graduated, I came out. It wasn't like I was waiting, it just sort of happened at that same time frame. But we also have communicated. We have many, many friends who have gone and who are still going to BYU. And I feel like we have a fairly good idea, both from our own experiences and from the experiences of others, what it can be like for a student at BYU. Brigham Young is a great school. It really is. They have some amazing programs. They have a lot going for them. They have some wonderful sports teams. And I truly do think that they care a lot about their students. They're also very, very fervently afraid of them, I think. They're afraid of, or they want to make sure that they have control over what their students say and think. And one of the ways that we see that was in the way that they handle and historically have handled students who are LGBT, who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. Being a person who is out at Brigham Young is almost a misnomer. It until very, very recently, it was actually just the sheer fact of saying that, hey, I'm gay or I'm bisexual at Brigham Young was grounds for dismissal. Having any sort of a relationship, albeit non-sexual in many cases, has historically been grounds for immediate dismissal. And so what we wanted to do is kind of give you some ideas of what it would be, some stories that would kind of demonstrate some of the personal prejudices that have occurred at BYU towards students who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And this would be not necessarily from an institutional standpoint, but from a personal standpoint, some of the things that are said and done that can help students who attend BYU and who are LGBT feel in many ways, the way I feel about it is that they feel very alienated. They often feel very alone, like they can't talk to anybody. The overriding factor on most of the people that I have spoken with, and the concept that I see most frequently with people, is that they're afraid. They're terrified. And yes, there are many times where it's not something that is with them 24/7, but it's something that they know they have to hide. They know they can't speak to people. They know that when somebody says something that is back, because they're afraid of what the reaction might be. And so we each just have thought about a couple of things in our own experiences while there, and we're just going to share a couple of quick stories with you that kind of demonstrate this personal prejudice against LGBT people that is altogether too often found at BYU. Matt will start, then Emil, and then myself.
Okay. As was said, I'm an English major, both at BYU and at the U now, and this happened in one of my English classes at BYU. I had a great teacher who most of my fellow students would have described as liberal. And one particular day, we were discussing some poetry. As often happens in class discussion, we get a little off topic. And I don't know, there was no real connection. But one of the students to my left raised his hand and said something to the effect of, "Well, it's just like gay people." And then he went on to explain how essentially evil gay people are and how we have a lot in common with the terrorists who blew up the trade towers on September 11, 2001, a comparison that I didn't appreciate a whole lot. Luckily, my professor stepped up to suggest that perhaps there was a little bit more than an inch of separation between terrorism and pursuing a gay relationship, which I appreciated very much. But that's just a brief example. And many of the things that gay students, lesbian students would come across at BYU would just be simple comments like that.
My experience comes from, my major information technology, I didn't really come across many topics in classroom discussions on homosexuality. But as it happened, I had to take a ethics course for my major. And the professor there, it seemed more of a what you should do as a Mormon in the world as opposed to just standard ethics. And I can't remember the exact thing that we were talking about, but in some way he brought up the choice of abortion, and on the same vein he was like, and the choice of homosexuality, both are abominable, both are like, you know, dangerous to society, and blah, blah, blah. The first time he said it, I was just kind of like, yeah, this is BYU, I kind of expect that. And then he said it again, and it just really irked me, so I decided to write him an email and was like, you don't seem to understand that being gay isn't a choice, that this isn't something that no one would choose this for themselves, to be ridiculed, to be born in a world where it's not accepted. And saying these things in class, you have no idea how many people there are at BYU that struggle with being gay. And saying these things in class doesn't really help them in wanting to, whatever, you know, path they choose, to do what the right thing for themselves. And he wrote me back an email that was, was very disheartening to me. It just seemed like he hadn't really heard what I said. He didn't believe me. He was like, "Well, I still believe I'm right." He called our situation a weakness at best, and just, you know, kind of demeaned the whole, like, person who I was in a way. Said, "Well, you know, you may think that, you know, you didn't choose this, but I know you did. Well, I don't think you do because you're not me." But anyway, so just not from the students, from the teachers too. It was there. So, Mike.
You know, there are a lot of examples that can be talked about here. For what it's like. I don't think for a second that LGBT students are the only ones who face prejudice, because that's definitely not true. but I think they are one of the few groups, especially at Brigham Young, who face these prejudices with very little being said to counteract the statements that are made. I, too, have had professors who have made unfair comparisons or comparisons that are based on misinformation, mistruth, or misguided ideas. I think that, you know, much like it at many schools, but these kind of things can happen. But at Brigham Young, there's very little to curb the statements that can be made. One of the major sources of prejudice that I see at Brigham Young in the students themselves is the idea that is so often talked about at in the wards, the student wards that are there, where the students who are in these wards are constantly being given advice, constantly given talks that talk about the need to get married, the need to date, the need to have the young men of the ward get up off their tushes and stop playing video games and go ask a sister out because they need to be asked out. I do understand that that is a major need for Mormons to, you know, multiply and replenish the earth. And I can understand the concept. It is very difficult and very alienating for young LGBT kids to hear that and have that be the focus of so much of their Brigham Young existence. These talks are given in church devotionals, in the BYU devotionals on a frequent basis. You know, it nothing really sets you apart so much as to be told that your purpose here is to go ask that girl out. Your purpose here is to say yes to that man, young man who asks you out as a young lady. That's a really tough situation to be in. You know, I think about one of my personal experiences with this and some of the personal prejudices that I've seen. A young man in my ward, my sophomore year, right after I turned from my mission, was in his apartment, and he had a male friend over, and they were cuddling as they watched a movie. The young man was gay. His roommates came in, saw them, and immediately called the Honor Code office and the office of the president and told them that not only what he had done, but that they would no longer, they had also called the office of the apartment complex, and they would no longer be willing to room with him, and that he had to be removed immediately, if not sooner. They also went and told everyone in our ward what had happened. I've never heard such a firestorm of ill-conceived and mean statements from a group of students who I know to be good-hearted, who I know that they really, these are good people, and yet the vile venom that dripped from their tongues as they talked about this situation and how this person could be so far gone into Satan's grasp that he would do this. That's a tough thing to face. You know? It was a very trying experience for me. As I was starting to deal with these kind of situations myself. And I know that these are not isolated experiences. Many, many students are at BYU who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And it's a tough situation to be in. Many people would ask, why would you go to BYU if you're LGBT? And so we actually spent a lot of time talking about this on the Equality Ride. You know, why in the world would you go to a place where you are demeaned or discriminated against? And so we've had to really come up and think about some of these things ourselves. I would say that for the most part, many of the kids, the young adults who go to BYU, are not out even to themselves in any way when they first go. This is something that many students who go to BYU go there after their missions. You know, and for a young LDS kid to go on a mission is the only thing that you are looking for as a young man, looking forward to in your life up until you're 19 years old. It's really difficult to get past that. And so you're many times avoiding even thinking about orientation, even thinking about how you might feel about this, because you know you need to go on a mission. And so at BYU is where a lot of these kids are actually faced with the situation for the first time. How do I feel about this? What do I actually feel? Other reasons, really quick. I know I'm taking a little while here. Other reasons would be parents will pay for it. I have several friends who are at BYU right now because their parents will pay for BYU and no other school. Their grandparents will pay for it. I have two friends who are there because individually because their grandparents said, "I will buy you a car if you go to BYU. If you don't, you get nothing." BYU is a family thing. Every one of my siblings has gone to BYU. There's a lot of familial pressure to go. There's a lot of expectation to go to BYU. BYU is dirt cheap. A lot of students who would go to other schools, perhaps, come to BYU because it's a great education and it's really, really inexpensive. There are a multitude of other reasons, but as we've outlined, there are quite a few reasons right now why LGBT students would want to come to BYU. And one of the most major reasons is because LGBT students are Mormon as well. This is the religion of their life. This is who they were brought up to be. You can't just differentiate I'm LDS or I'm Mormon. For the grand majority of people, they're both. It's part of who they are. It's part of their identity. And many of these students want to be in a place where other LDS youth are. You know, so I think we've tried to outline a little bit here some of the ideas for personal prejudice and how those play a role in BYU. I know Matt's going to kind of talk to us a little bit about how the differences between personal or an ideological prejudice as opposed to a more discriminatory action. And he'll explain that from the institutional standpoint.
Okay, as Mike said, that was a little bit of a look into what it's like to deal person to person as a gay student at BYU for us and for some of the people that we know. However, to back up further from that, to back up from prejudice, something that someone might feel personally, be taught personally, or think personally, and then just to step back and see the difference between prejudice and discrimination. Discrimination is use of stereotype, the use of specific ideologies or belief systems that would other or privilege one class of people over another. And many times, this is not overt at all. I went to BYU for 2.5 years, and never did I hear of anyone being physically assaulted for being LGBT. I don't think that's the way it usually expresses itself. Usually, discrimination shows itself in a much more sort of under-the-table way. And one of the ways that it chiefly takes that form that we addressed on the Equality Ride and that we continue to address now is something called spiritual violence. And Emil's going to talk a little bit about what spiritual violence is and some of the forms and consequences that it takes.
So basically, discrimination would just be prejudice with power. You know, people can have individual prejudices, but when you have power behind you, when people look to you as an authority, or look to an institution as authoritative. That is when you have discrimination. Like Matt said, one of the things we talked about a lot as we went across the country, we stopped at about 20 different schools for our bus and talked with thousands and thousands of young Christian youth, for the most part. We talked about this concept that many of them had never heard anything about, and that was spiritual violence. Spiritual violence has a pretty easy definition that we liked to talk about with people, and that was spiritual violence is the misuse of religion to sanction the condemnation or the rejection of any of God's children. Using spiritual ideology, using scripture, using the religion itself to, as Matt said, to other people, to make people feel as if they are the other, the outcast, the ones that are not with the rest of them. That does a great deal of violence. This violence can be found in many forms. You know, it can be as simple as I just feel like I am unwelcome. It can be being told that you are unwelcome. I have been in a church meeting where the pastor stood and invited those who have these evil feelings, quote unquote, to leave and never come back. I have talked with dear friends who have been in situations in church meetings where, luckily as LDS we don't see this very often, but where the pastors and reverends call down hellfire and damnation upon the vile sinners that are LGBT people, not making any differentiation between people who are same-sex attracted and are trying fervently to not have anything to do with that, to the people who are, you know, wearing chaps and tutus walking down the street, you know, in the gay pride parades. This is one of the things that does violence to people, and sometimes spiritual violence can have devastating effects as it leads to physical violence. I don't know. Emil's going to talk to us a little bit about some of these other consequences of spiritual violence that I've started to outline here.
Spiritual violence is sort of like evident by what it causes. So, like you see what it does to the person, and then you realize that what had been done to the person was spiritual violence. Usually manifests itself by that. Some of the things are like family rejection, like coming out to your parents and them having them basically say that we no longer accept you as our son or daughter, and they kick you out of their homes. I got this off the internet. It's a wonderful thing. It says that most of the runaway teens in the big cities are probably throwaway LGBT kids who have been rejected by their families before they can even, you know, learn how to survive on their own. Being rejected often leads to self-hate, and you really can't live with yourself when you hate yourself. So it often leads to death or suicide. And I had a thought earlier about, in particular, to religion. Oh, it was that spiritual violence, as with the misuse of religions, often burns people from religion in general, from God, from like being able to have to live a spiritual life. They have all this influence around them that's so overtly spiritual, and it burns them. It scars them for life, and they don't feel like they could ever touch that again. They don't feel like they can ever go back to it, in however form they may find it. But And so I feel that in and of itself is probably one of the most harmful things, is because a personal religion within yourself, a personal owning, you know, a faith in God, helps people to live, helps people to survive, and being rejected by that can ultimately kill oneself without even actually ending the physical life. So, anything else you guys wanted to add? Or?
Just two really quick examples. We have a personal friend who was one of the writers last year who was taken, grabbed by three large men as she walked out of a restaurant and was beaten so badly that she's had to have reconstructive surgery on her face several times because she was perceived as a lesbian. They called her a dyke and continued to punch her until she passed out. Another form of spiritual violence is when people use the things that they've been taught or the things that they've learned in church to justify physical violence against LGBT people. One of the worst cases of this is an example where a young man had been listening to his pastor talk in one of his pastor's favorite topics about hellfire and damnation on the accursed gays, walked into a gay couple's house and stood above them in their bed and shot them with several times each, killing them. This happened in 1998. While in jail, he was asked why he had done this and how he was going to what he was going to plead. He said, "I am going to plead not guilty because it is in the scriptures that these people need to be killed. I've read this myself. I plan to defend myself from the scriptures. I have done nothing wrong." This is spiritual violence. When people are told things that they can interpret or that they can understand as not the intent of perhaps the pastor, but that it can be so badly misused as to create a situation where people feel unwelcomed, where people feel threatened, or where people actually are threatened with bodily harm.
One of the most often observable consequences of spiritual violence is simply the feeling of the individual toward themselves. And I'd like to just draw a quick differentiation between the concept of guilt and the concept of shame. To demonstrate, let me tell you a little story. When I was 7 years old, just after my family moved to Spokane, Washington, my mom needed some things from the grocery store, and so I went with my dad to go shopping. I saw a pack of gum that I really wanted, pocketed it, and made the stupid mistake of chewing that gum as soon as I got home. I was 7. My dad was standing with me as I pulled out this gum and put it in my mouth. And he, of course, asked me where I had gotten it after looking a little sheepish and then responding. He told me that we were going to go back to the grocery store where I would hand it back and say I was sorry for stealing. What I felt in that situation is most commonly referred to as guilt. I did something bad. I knew it. I could feel it. What I felt as a gay man growing up in the church was something different. What I felt there was shame. And shame says very simply, I am bad. It's interesting. I remember the first time sort of wrapping my mind around this concept of shame. It was before I came out to my family at 19, and before I had had any relationship with another gay man. And we had just heard a a talk about dating from the new Strength of Youth pamphlet. They have a newer one now, but this was the previous. And it talked about dating in the pamphlet, and we had a Sunday school lesson or something on the subject. There was a relatively well-known quote from The Miracle of Forgiveness. I'm not going to be able to quote it with accuracy, but it basically says that masturbation will lead to homosexuality. Spencer W. Kimball was the one who said it. And the quote was brought up, and I don't want to get too detailed, but I felt wrong in myself as an individual. Not that I had done something bad, but that I was bad because I had recognized my attraction to other men.
We're going to talk about the advocacy or the clauses in the BYU Honor Code that, if some of you might know, that it has recently been redefined, changed. And the before one, when I first started going to BYU, this is what it said. It said, "Brigham Young University will respond to student behavior rather than to feelings or orientation. Students can be enrolled at the university and remain in good honor code standing if they maintain a current ecclesiastical endorsement and conduct their lives in manner consistent with gospel principles and the honor code. Advocacy of a homosexual lifestyle, whether implied or explicit, or any behaviors that indicate homosexual conduct, including those not sexual in nature, are inappropriate and violate the honor code. Violations of the honor code may result in actions up to and including separation from the university." So, reading that before, when I was closeted, didn't really mean much to me because, to me, I hadn't accepted myself. I didn't know what to accept. I didn't know what to think. And then after finally saying, okay, you know what, I'm gay. All right, now what is it that the honor code says I can't do? It says, advocacy of a homosexual lifestyle, whether implied or explicit. So I didn't know from this whether or not I could go up to somebody and say, yeah, I'm gay. He's like, well, what does that mean? Just saying you're gay, does that say you're like you're advocating for a gay lifestyle? Just being on campus, I mean, eating food, drinking water, thinking, talking, speaking, every action that I did was gay, in my opinion. I mean, that's who I was. Just like every action that a straight person does is straight because that's who he is. And so I thought the wording was really, really off. And I told them that when I got disciplined for my involvement with Soul Force. I was like, your honor code doesn't specify, you know, what it is that you want to see. So they ended up changing it, and now it says, there's some things that they get the same. Members of the university community, right. One stated sexual orientation is not an honor code issue. However, the honor code requires all members of the university community to manifest a strict commitment to the law of chastity. Homosexual behavior and or advocacy of homosexual behavior are inappropriate and violate the honor code. Homosexual behavior includes not only sexual relations between members of the same sex, but all forms of physical intimacy that give expression to homosexual feelings. Advocacy includes seeking to influence others to engage in homosexual behavior or promoting homosexual relations as being morally acceptable. We have several friends at BYU who are currently trying to create a sort of like an open space, open environment, which anybody can come and just talk about these things. But they're running into a lot of problems because they still can't quite get to the point where it's okay to say it's okay to be gay, or it's okay to have these feelings, or it's morally acceptable because the honor code says you can't say that. So, yeah, I don't know what else I was going to say about that. Okay. I get it now. Okay, so basically what we're going to try to explain is the message sent from something and the message received. So Mike's going to do that.
This concept of message sent, message received, is something that I've thought a lot about, that I've actually given several lectures on and talked with many different people about. And it pertains to all aspects of life. The basic concept is very simple. What I say and how I feel, I give my very best effort every time I speak to somebody to convey my thought in its entirety, my feeling about that subject, to them, and hoping that they will understand what I mean and feel and understand how I meant that. One of the major problems that we have with this issue is that has kind of already been outlined somewhat. The message that's being sent to the LGBT students at BYU for pretty much up until this recent change has been one that was very, very difficult to understand. They talked about the difference between explicit or implied behavior. What is an implied behavior? I kind of thought, well, you know, is a football player smacking each other on the butt, is that a homosexual behavior? Are two girls who give hugs while one of them is feeling bad, is that a homosexual behavior? Or is me talking with my friend, where both of us are gay, is that a homosexual behavior? Is this something that I can be sanctioned for? The message that's being sent, and that was sent by the honor code prior to this last year, was one where you did not know. It was one of fear. It was one of unclarity. It was not clear at all. So I'm one of the first people to say I'm very happy that the changes have been made to the honor code for this school, because things are a little bit more clear now. I say a little bit because there's still a lot of change that can be made and that needs to be made. But the message sent, message received concept is something that I think is very important, especially when we consider some of the religious spiritual violence that we see and that we read about. When Jerry Falwell gets up and says that the reason that we were attacked in America was because of the ... and gay and lesbian people in this country on 9/11. When the Katrina, Pat Robertson, when the Hurricane Katrina, Pat Robertson blames in part on the active LGBT influence in this country. That's sending a pretty powerful message. That's sending a message to people that maybe they don't intend to have people go out and beat up gay people. But guess what? Physical violence towards LGBT people has increased 200%, 300% in some areas since the end of the Cold War, when religious leaders kind of had to stop using communism as one of their ways to raise money and have since switched to abortion and homosexuality. The things that are being said have consequences. Sometimes these are deadly consequences. The messages that are being sent when a priest quorum advisor talks about certain subjects like Matt just brought up and compares and uses quotes like that Spencer W. Kimball quote, the message that's being sent there to all of the young men is that not just the fact that gay people are bad, but that they are the most vile and horrible things that someone could be. Imagine being told that, sometimes overtly, sometimes in a roundabout way, your whole life. How would you feel about yourself? What kind of self-esteem could you possibly have as a young person who is just trying to deal with these thoughts and feelings that he's had his whole life, that he can't differentiate between who he is with these feelings and who he is without them. They're just an intrinsic part of him or her. It's this concept of message sent, message received that makes me stand up and talk. That makes me not be willing to sit back and let others run these gauntlets, let others figure these things out. I have to say something, because the message that are being sent by the brethren when they make comments that are based on bad research, when they're making comments that are based on findings by organizations like NARTH, by people like Dean Bird, they're based on bad information. They're based on bad mistruths. And they're hurting people. People hear this, and they base their entire concept of what a gay person is based on what they hear at church. And if what they're hearing at church is wrong, no one is there to tell them otherwise. Message sent, message received is a concept that I think we all need to consider in our lives, even while talking with our friends. There's a message that's being received when I hear a gay joke and I don't say anything. The people around me who laugh are hearing a message loud and clear from me if I don't say anything. So I think that it's a concept that we should all really consider in our lives.
Okay. I'd like to talk to you briefly about a theme that I observe in the LDS community, and one that's often directed toward the LGBT community, not necessarily mutually exclusive. And the concept, it was actually originally conceived of by Gandhi, but it's the idea of love the sinner, hate the sin. How many of you are familiar with this concept? There's a question that I'd like to talk about here, actually. And if you'd like to participate, I'd really appreciate it. The question is this. For those of you who identify as straight in this room, those who are attracted to the opposite gender, when precisely in your lives, in your day-to-day lives, are you straight? Is there a specific time of day? When precisely are you straight? If you identify as straight,
always. Do you want an answer?
I would like an answer. Yeah.
I have
my first wet dream. Oh boy, we're not going to get into that either.
The point is, it's not between, you know, 9 to 5.
I was going to say, 24 hours a day. You feel. And I can't ever say at any moment in my life I chose to be straight. I just probably have
been. One thing that I've noticed as I've examined my own life is that sexual identity, sexual orientation, is extremely complicated. People ask all the time, well, were you born that way? Or when did you choose this? And frankly, it's not that simple. And I don't think it's an either-or answer. I think that there are a number of factors, and I don't understand them. All I know is that deep down inside, I understand that never was a choice presented to me that I'm aware of, where I was able to say, yes, that's the route I'd like to take. That doesn't happen in my day-to-day life. I don't think it will. And so back to this concept of love the sinner, hate the sin. What love the sinner, hate the sin teaches is to accept someone as, in religious language, as a child of God. to recognize that that's where they come from, that's where they're going, and to recognize that they do things that are sinful. So there's this differentiation between who they are and what they do. And as I've thought about that differentiation and where I can draw that line in light of my own experience trying to find out when I chose to be gay, I can't find a definitive line for it. I can't find a place where my identity stops and my behavior starts. One of the concepts that I really enjoy, I got this from a mission president in England, is a book, a small book, by James Allen called As a Man Thinketh. And it basically teaches that thoughts lead to actions, actions leads to habits, and habits lead to the formation of character. As a simple concept, I like this very much. It gives me some tools to change the little things about my life that I'd like to change, to affirm the things that I like about my thoughts and my actions. And yet, in LDS culture, there seems to be the expectation that certain thoughts will lead to only certain actions, like a train moving from destination A to, or from point A to destination B. And I would suggest that it's not that simple. I would suggest that thoughts are sort of like seeds, and they sprout and grow, and the path up the tree is myriad. Could go anywhere. I don't want to get too specific here, but let's use an extreme example, one that typically comes to mind. When a lot of my conservative friends hear the word gay, they think of sex. When I think of sex, sex is not a train ride to promiscuous drug-induced behavior. Sometimes when I think of sex, it makes me want to throw up a little bit. More often than not, it makes me want to examine myself. It makes me want to think where my morals lie, why they lie there, what choices I make lead to certain actions, and how those things can affect me as consequences in my life. So often when we think about things, obviously, it can make us grow. It doesn't just have to be a negative response. To move out a little bit more than that, love the sin or hate the sin tends to affect the LGBT community very directly. These associated brain pathways tend to lead for the conservative mind to condemnation and condemnation only. And again, I would suggest that the pathways moving from that starting point are myriad. There's a lot more to it. Now we'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk directly about our experiences with Soul Force, with the Equality Ride, and with activism in general. Typically, when one seeks in their life to do things that would change others' perceptions of them or a class of people, it can be so simple as example. Just going about your daily life as, in my case, a gay man who's accepted himself and affirms his sexual identity, and who believes that I can have a relationship with a man that is God-centered. That example idea, very common in Mormon culture, is just simply changing people's hearts and minds as you meet them, as you go throughout your daily life. And in my experience, that's not really, at least directly, the role of activism. In my experience, activism is seeking to challenge discrimination. So again, not people's personal prejudices per se, but rather an institutionalized form of prejudice, that classifying or othering of a whole class of people. And unless there's anything that someone wants to add, we have a short video about our experiences on the Equality Ride. Okay.
bear my testimony here that I was raised in a family that taught me morals and ethics and love. It taught me faith. My family taught me how to belong to something, how to fight for something, how to truly and fully love something, and someone. I was raised in a church that taught those exact same values, and I uphold those values completely. I came to the realization that I had same gender attraction at a very, very early age. I actually wrote it down in my fourth grade journal, so nobody can dispute it. I struggled for many years in the closet and dealing mainly with matters of where do I fit in with my religion all through high school, and many cases that led to severe depression, severe hatred of myself. And when that began to change was when I met a friend in high school who was just so confident about himself and was so confident that I was the coolest person in the world that I felt like I couldn't do any wrong. And I finally began to talk about these issues with him. And that became the ultimate thing for me, to be able to talk to somebody about what I'm feeling, about what I'm going through, about what I'm experiencing. And that to me is a personal testimony of how important it can be to express yourself. I stopped hating myself when I was able to talk about things to people. And I found that most of the reactions I got were positive reactions. And I think that that's something that we forget a lot because we are so afraid to speak out. I think from my personal experience, my testimony of my personal experience at BYU, that environment of fear is way too prevalent. That fear permeates every aspect of my experience at BYU, completely defines it. And I want to basically encourage everybody to stand up and to have the courage to speak out, to end that fear and to end that silence. And it's what I truly believe, and I'd like to leave that with you in the name of truth and honesty and love and progression. Thank you.
This year?
Two
people. Court Osborne, who was one of the equality riders, who grew up in Kanab in an LDS family, and his mother.
Why were they arrested?
They were arrested for trespassing. They were attempting to deliver a 55-page long list of concerns and grievances that we had gathered from former and current BYU students. That was. Yes. That was that. Actually, this is our Q&A time, so.
What happened to the list? You go and dine where would have gotten it?
Well, I still have a copy of it, of course. I was the one who organized the compilation. But we believe it was read. We're not entirely sure.
We hope so.
But it was delivered. We had it, because it wasn't able to be delivered by court, we had it mailed the next morning. Yeah. And actually, if I would have been intelligent about this, I would have brought a copy with me tonight. I'm sorry about that.
I missed something when you were talking about the whole local center incident thing. I wasn't sure if you were saying that's possible to do that or impossible.
Okay. I think that in some cases it may be possible. In the case of someone's identity, I don't think it's possible to do that.
When you're gay, you are a descendant.
Precisely. It comes back to that idea of shame versus guilt. The connection between identity and behavior here is so misty that I could not find it. I could not find where identity ended and behavior began. And I think that that's largely true for most who are LGBT, who are raised in the LDS Church.
Well, I can only speak for my personal perspective. I was raised in a Mormon. I'm a Christian.
Oh, okay.
Sure,
sure.
I mean, I've dialogued with people from all walks of life, all kinds of issues they're involved in. I don't care if they're in the Grand Theft Auto or whatever. I can talk to the person in the meeting and share my faith with them. And, you know, I have concerns with it. So, I mean, I know how I operate around people that I disagree with are in some form of sin. Again, because I label it sin doesn't mean that I dislike that person. Fearful of that person. I've talked to all kinds of people, including people in the gay life, and I don't fear them. I just talk to them like normal people. And it's not my job to convert them to anything. That's God's job. But at the same point, in the same way, though, I mean, I understand what the person says, that it's hard for them to realize that person they love, and they still see that that person's involved in the sin. I've been doing it for years, talking to people very things that I know that I don't agree with, but I think are wrong. But yet I treat them with respect, I treat them with care. I mean, I've never told a homosexual joke in my life, and I think it's wrong to put people down just because they're in a certain group of people. But, so I guess, I mean, I know what I can do with people and how I can talk to them. So, from my perspective, it is possible.
Have brought up a point that we talked with lots of people about. And in many ways, yes, I would agree. When we're talking about expressly about behaviors, about something that someone does, that this concept of hating the sin but loving the sinner does make sense, and it works. What we're talking about here, however, and entirely too many cases, this concept is brought up, whether it's actually being said, hate the sin, love the sinner, or whether it's just being intimated into the conversation that we have, is that this is being applied not to homosexual actions, not to something that someone sees as a sin that a gay person does, but that homosexuality in general is a sin. You can't differentiate between what someone is, and if you label that a sin, you are hating the sinner by his very existence. That is the message that I talked about with lots of people, is that by and large, in my experience, when these issues are talked about by religious organizations, they are not talking about behavior. They are talking about identity. And you cannot differentiate between identity and person. They're one and the same.
Well, I'm not saying I'm not
Yeah, I understand that. Always nice to be labeled as part of that group.
Disagree with that. I would hope not. The point is, I'm not going to get into a discussion.
I've seen it lead to many difficult impasses when we talk about whether or not behaviors are sinful. To that, I think that everyone has an equal right to their opinion and to their own understanding of this as it pertains to their relationship with God. And I fully support that idea. What my basic point is exactly what you just said. The identity of someone cannot inherently be sinful unless you are willing to say that someone, through no fault or action of their own, is inherently sinful. And that is the point that we wanted to make with the fallacy of saying that you can hate the sin but love the sinner when you are hating. The sin that you are hating is someone's identity. Does that make sense? We can talk to you. I'd be more than willing to talk a little bit afterwards, but there were a couple other questions here about that. Is that okay?
Well, no, I understand that.
Okay.
But I'm saying that for me, the dialogue with people who are involved in what I would consider sin is not hard.
Right.
And I don't think it's differently than I would treat somebody who I think is a dull-working individual, or rock-solid, whatever.
I wish everyone was like that. Give it a good shot.
I
was agreeing with you there. I think we should. Very much so. Yeah, understand. I think we had a question over here and then one back there.
I'm just wondering, what are some positive experiences that you guys had?
Positive experiences? Lots.
As students or?
As students. Okay. Yeah, as students, as gay students, or as students with white
things like that. I got some good ones.
Go for it.
Okay. The reason I'm an English major, you can put that all to the professors that I had at BYU. I had an English class that I was required to take. While I was a psychology major. And I just enjoyed it too much and realized that I had a passion for writing and that writing is something that I wanted to pursue for my entire life. And so it was largely my experiences with the English department there that put me on that career path. In fact, that idea of the difference between prejudice versus discrimination, that was first introduced to me at BYU in an English class. Another another example was actually with a student ward bishop that I had. He had a class that he organized on a stake level during Sunday school that invited, by bishop's invitation only, certain members of the ward, usually those who felt disenfranchised or othered on the outside. And when I came out to him in my first interview with him, he invited me right off the bat to come to this class. And it was one of the greatest experiences with Sunday school that I ever had. And that happened at BYU. Very, very positive stuff. Anybody else?
Can I just make a couple really quick comments on that? One of the greatest experiences I had at BYU was in talking with a teacher. It was probably the first person that I didn't come out to this woman. I was very close to graduation, but I talked about these issues, and I think she, probably being a very, very perceptive, intelligent woman, knew exactly what I was saying. But she played along and didn't force me to out myself to her. But she said some of the most humane and kind things that I have ever heard. She was a professor of theology at BYU, and where so many of the ones that we've talked about have not been great examples, she was a wonderful example to me. She said things that were kind. She said things that we don't understand these issues, and that I wish we would, and I wish people would not say things in such an ill light on BYU students. Another one, really quick, of the best experiences I had there was when we came back this year and talked with students. We were not allowed on campus. We were told that any one of us setting a toe on campus would result in our immediate arrest, no matter what our intention was, as the Soul Force Equality Right group. So we held group discussions off campus. And I had the opportunity to talk with close to 100 different students in several different groups about some of these issues. And I could see not just the interest, but the desire to understand these issues as they pertained from a real-life experience. Not being taught something from someone who has no experience with this, not being shown examples of this in church, but to actually talk to somebody from a similar background, from a similar concept of reality of the world, and to see the interest and the understanding that it engendered. That for me is the reason why I'm involved with activism, is because I've had too many experiences of having people cry on my shoulder, of having people not know what to do, and just feeling so alienated. And to see the dialogue that was possible with these ultra-conservative students at BYU, to see the understanding and this dark clouds of misunderstanding and cultural hatred get lifted as we discuss these issues.
In the back first, and then in the white.
Oh, I just wanted to say I'm a gay graduate of BYU 15 years ago, and I'm just a little sad that it just seemed like back then, okay, I understand, it was a different society everywhere, and it's a little sad that this culture sounds like it's just so oppressive still, and hasn't progressed at all, because the world culture, North American culture, in so many places has gone so far, and in those 15 years, consider Utah County better than I was when I went there. But there are so many other places that are wonderful, and I hope all of you do really well. And
thank you.
Thank you.
They are
getting better.
Real fast.
A couple years ago, a friend of mine died, and his name was Dennis, and he had lived in a 55-year relationship with Melanie Wallace. They met when they were about 20, and lived together for the next 55 years, made all the decisions about career and where to live and so forth, like a married couple with, and a very fine couple of individuals. I have no idea how they express their love for each other. I care less, and I hope anybody else would care less. And I would hate to have been a person who, in 1950 or 51, had talked them out of their relationship because it was a sin. I can't imagine how anybody could conceive their relationship as a sin.
Thank you all so much for coming. We really appreciate it. Thanks for the questions, the comments.